Let me mention just for a moment, because we were a little hurried this morning during the worship time and did not have the opportunity to introduce any visitors or guests. We normally try to do that, but if you are a visitor, we would encourage you to fill out one of these cards that hopefully you will find in the red songbook in either the front or the back. If not, there are some extra cards on the table back there. We'd like you to fill one in and place that in the box at the back. And we ask you to do that only so that we may be able to minister to you in a more personal way if you so desire it. Several weeks ago, when I was still on vacation, Jim Ellis, who I think a number of you know, and Gail were out to visit us at my parents' place on the lake in Washington State. They, of course, are as used to Dallas, or more so than we. And we walked about. I showed them the tall, green, evergreen trees. And we looked at the lake. We swam in the lake. And we were walking through one of my father's fields. And Jim turned to me and said, "Tell me again, why is it you want to go back to Dallas?" I must admit, that question comes to my mind every summer about vacation time. We get to leave the green trees and come back down to the heat. But I told Jim that God had called us to minister to people, not places. I have to rethink that every year. I stopped in Oregon to visit one of my friends who is a pastor in a small church in Beaver, Oregon. He showed me a picture of his fishing trip, and he had 5 salmon. The smallest was 24 pounds, and the biggest was 46. I always get these dreams. Paul Furseth used to call them the Macedonian call. It's a big salmon who says, "Come up to Oregon and help us." There is in all of us, I think, a desire to get out of the city and to go to the country. And many of us probably would like to sanctify it with a misconstrued concept of separation. In fact, many would think that perhaps Genesis chapter 19 was a beautiful illustration of the wickedness of living in a city and the devastating results of it. I think it teaches us something else about separation. We really wouldn't know, would we, from reading this chapter, that Lot was a Christian. In fact, I suppose we would have guessed that he wasn't. But Peter tells us that Lot was a righteous man and that his soul was vexed as he looked at the wickedness of the city about him. But he was a weak man. He was one who was saved literally by being dragged out, kicking and screaming and dragging his feet. He's a man very much like you and me, perhaps too much so. And that, I think, is what the text is telling us about. Verses 1 through 11, I think, set the scene. Obviously, they convince us that the city of Sodom is worthy of destruction. And they also give us at least a semi-positive introduction to this man, Lot. I believe that Lot was as ignorant of the identity of his two visitors as was Abraham initially too. And there is a similarity in the hospitality, and I think a deliberate one, and I try and play off, as I understand it, the hospitality of Lot and the homosexuality of the city. Certainly, Lot was intending to do good, and the people of the city were intending to do harm. The two angels came, and we find Lot sitting at the city gate. I find that interesting. I must confess to you that I don't think as highly of Lot as some. I look at him as a sort of a Billy Carter of Sodom. I'll tell you why. I am not sure. I see the city gate as a place of prominence, and it is true. Job describes his sitting at the city gate as the exercise of judicial authority, as one who sits as an elder and who pronounces judgment on cases. It may well be that Lot was in a position of some degree of authority and power and prominence. But I think it was derived, myself. I think it was derived from Abraham. And the reason why I think so is the history of what happened. Remember that Lot had moved to Sodom, and I suppose nobody had paid any attention to him particularly, other than he was a stranger, and he surely was not one of them. And as a matter of fact, he still isn't. They refer to him as an alien, and that's been years since he moved to town. But you see, when Lot moved to Sodom, you remember that the kings of the northeast came down, and they sacked Sodom. And they took Lot and all of his possessions and all of the possessions of Sodom and the people, and they took them off as spoils. Well, somebody came to the rescue, and his name was Abraham. Abraham was well thought of. And you remember that Abraham refused to take a part of the spoils. So that Abraham was a hero in Sodom, even though he didn't live there. And I think that Lot's reputation and his power was derivative from that of Abraham. Well, anyway, Lot is at the city gate, and he is sitting there, and as he sees these two strangers, he goes out to meet them, and he bows down to the ground, and here is a second offer of hospitality. He asks them to turn in, and since it is not time for the noon meal, it is not siesta time, it is time to bed down for the night, Lot invites them to come. I think that a lot of his fervor is out of fear rather than faith. Lot knew what that city was capable of, and this probably was certainly not the first instance of immorality and violation of the rights of a stranger. And so he asked them to turn aside, and he invites them to spend the night. Initially, they decline politely, I think, as a part of the culture, and then they give in to his persistent pleas and urgings, much as our Lord did in Luke chapter 24 with the two men on the road to Emmaus. Now, I personally see the feast that is described here as not quite as so leisurely and as lavish as that described in chapter 18. Now, you might think that it was a great feast, but that expression, prepared a feast, is actually a term that although most of the time it's describing a feast, it really has to do with drinking, that is, with drinking wine. And it is used here because oftentimes a great banquet, a lavish banquet, a feast, was one that had wine with it. Esther prepared a feast for Haman and the king, same word. I think here, however, and if you'll notice even some of the commentaries and some of the translations reflect this, I am not so sure that it is the feast that is prepared so much as he has prepared them with something to drink and some bread to eat. I see it as a hasty meal. I see Lot as fearful of leaving these men on the street, fearful of the townspeople learning they are there, and when he says that you ought to rise early and go on your way, I think he meant it. Very early. I suspect the alarm went off about 4 o'clock in the morning, or it would have. So as I see it, the unleavened bread is something that is prepared in haste. He did not want his wife, Mrs. Lot, to prepare rising bread. They didn't have time to wait for the bread to rise. They had to have a snack and get to bed so they could get out of town early in the morning. I may be reading that in partially, but it is clearly unleavened bread, that which is prepared in haste, and so I am not so sure that the feast is quite like the feast of chapter 18. Unfortunately, or at least in Lot's mind, the men of the city had taken notice of the strangers too, for a different reason. And so they have converged upon the house, and I would wonder about that meal. I suspect that Lot may have had his ear sort of to the door as it was. And a crowd began to gather, and eventually you will notice that the whole city, virtually, of men at least, is gathered there around the house. And notice the complete depravity of the city. This is not a handful of rabble. This is not some group that is untypical of the city, but it is the city that is there. Young and old, all the people from every quarter. Good representation. In other words, the city was shot spiritually, and they were deserving of judgment. And so they called to Lot and demanded This is not the kind of liberal mentality where we say, well, whatever goes on between consenting adults behind closed doors is all right. This is rape. And, of course, of a very perverted sort. Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may have relations with them. Now, we've seen Lot in a fairly good light preparing the feast, and we will see him step out the door, and I think there is still at least an element of the commendable in him. He steps out, and you will notice he shut the door behind him. I really believe he was making every effort to protect those men from those men. But it doesn't last long, because when he steps outside the door and he shuts it, listen to what he says. Here's the courage that waters down into compromise rather quickly. Now behold, I have two daughters who have not had relations with man. Please let me bring them out to you and do with them whatever you like, only do nothing to these men, inasmuch as they have come under the shelter of my roof. That's not commendable, folks. That's cowardice. And what are you saying? And remember now, in the East, one who came under the roof of a man, that man who owned that house had an obligation. Some say it was for 3 days or whatever it was, but to bring protection to that man. To step under a man's roof was to have his protection, his guarantee of safety. And Lot is out to preserve, in effect, his reputation. But he is willing to sacrifice his two daughters, and I am sure that any two daughters who are of this age and marriageable and have not known a man in Sodom, that must have taken something, and he is willing to write off all of those years of purity in order to preserve two people who he's never met before in his life. That is not commendable. They said, stand aside, out of the way. Some have even translated it, come out here, you come here. And they are after him as well. Furthermore, this one came in as an alien, and already he is acting like a judge. Now we will treat you worse than them. I get the distinct impression that Lot has not had much to say about their morality previously. Now, he's been there years. He isn't just in town for 6 weeks. He's no new member of the community. He's on the city council, and he's been there for years, and they're saying, now you're the judge. I think it's the first time he spoke up. Now, he was one of those silent witnesses. He was going to let his life speak louder than his lips. No need to make a big hassle. Just live a pure life and let everybody learn from it and ask why. They didn't want to know why. And they didn't want to hear him say anything now. So now they are ready finally to do away with Lot too. He has been a pain. They have endured him. Now they will take him with the others. Now, the irony of it is, Lot was willing to sacrifice his daughter to protect his guests. It ends up that his guests protect him and his daughters. They reach outside the door, grab him by the shirt or whatever, yank him in and shut the door. And then they cast this spell which visually impairs, I am not sure it blinds, it visually impairs those who are at the door, and you'll notice they wearied themselves trying to find the doorway. That's the same, the word for blindness there is the same terms that's used in 2 Kings chapter 6. Remember, Elijah has been telling the king about the plans of Syria, and Ben-Hadad finally gets the word, hey, look, it's Elijah. He hears what's going on. He's got your bedroom bugged. And he tells the king. Ben-Hadad goes out to wipe him out. He surrounds him with forces, and you remember that Elisha says to his servant, don't be afraid, for greater are those who are with us than those who are with them. And there were plenty of them. He prayed, and there was a spell of blindness that was brought upon them. And I see that more as a visual impairment. That is, it was a kind of an illusory thing. If they were just blind, I mean, all you have to do is recognize anybody, even as sick as these people were, and say, hey, look, school's out. Let's get out of this place. Something's wrong. But their vision was, I think, distorted. So they went, oh, here's the door, and he'd grab a brick. And, oh, it's over here. And they just wore themselves out. They couldn't even get to the door. They couldn't even feel the door, apparently. So I think there's a real impairment that takes place. Obviously, it is divine, and I think that Lot has now discovered the identity of his guests. I call this next section, verses 12 and following, Lot's last stand. And you know, as I wrote that down, I thought to myself, I've got a feeling it was not only his last, but his first. He knows now that there is judgment that is coming upon the city. Whom else have you here, the angel say, a son-in-law and your sons and your daughters and whomever you have in the city? Bring them out of the place, for we are about to destroy it. Now Lot feverishly goes out, and I think for the first time, very plainly and boldly professes the faith that he has and now the judgment of God that is coming. And Lot went out, and he spoke to his sons-in-law who are to marry his daughters. There is some question as to whether these are sons-in-law who have married, as the Greek translation renders it, or whether they are about to marry, meaning engaged. If these are sons-in-law in the sense that they are engaged to Lot's daughters, then they are probably engaged to the two that are still in his home and the two that go with Lot and flee the city. However, later in the text, it speaks about the daughters who were with Lot going with him. And we get the distinct impression, therefore, that there were daughters who were not with Lot, who did not go with him. Regardless, these are the sons-in-law. He appeals to them to flee the city, and you will notice their response. And I think this is the most tragic statement of the chapter. But he appeared to his sons-in-law to be jesting. There is nothing worse than not to be taken seriously. Nothing worse than that. A tremendous rebuke and reproach on the witness of Lot. You see, what I would have hoped to find, what I would have hoped had I been in Lot's shoes, is that people would have said to me, listen, Lot, we've been over this 1,000 times. You know that we don't believe what you believe, and you don't believe what we believe. We've argued about it. We've gone through it time and time again. Now, for crying out loud, leave me alone. But they don't say that. It doesn't say they refuse to believe him. It says they refuse to take him seriously. And the impression that I get then is that Lot comes wild-eyed. And believe me, you would be too. If you suddenly were aware that destruction was imminent, if you and I knew that there was 1 hour before Jesus Christ would come again, I have a feeling that we would have a fervor like Lot's. And probably, if we were as carnal as Lot, people would think we were as nutty as they thought he was. You're crazy. That's what they thought. Some kind of a gag in the middle of the night. This is the funniest one yet, Lot. I tell you, I seen you at some of the city council meetings. I thought you were funny, but you're really funnier than I thought. Not taken seriously. Not disbelieved, but discredited totally. So his whole missionary venture has been a failure. His whole life is a failure. There are no converts. There is no one. No one except those who are under his immediate authority leave. And you wonder, frankly, if his wife and his daughters could act independently of Lot, whether they would have gone either. Might take it one step farther. You wonder, had Lot not been grabbed by the arm, whether he would have gone. Total failure. So that the angels now, as morning is beginning to break, the angels say to Lot, up, take away your wife and your two daughters who are here. Notice, two daughters who are here. And it says, lest you be swept away in the punishment of the city. Here again, here's Lot. But he hesitated, foot dragging all the way. And so the angels grab him by the hand and the hand of his wife and the hands of his daughters, for the compassion of the Lord was upon him, and they brought him out of the city. Now, one would have thought that that was enough. I think Lot really believed that the city was going to be destroyed, but he didn't really want to leave it. Maybe he hoped that if he stayed there, it wouldn't be destroyed. He wouldn't lose all that he had spent his life working for. The angel said to him, escape for your life, do not look behind you, and do not stay anywhere in the valley. Escape to the mountains, lest you be swept away. Now, here is Lot's intercessory prayer. He's interceding for himself. Notice the contrast in this prayer with the prayer of Abraham. Abraham beseeches God, that he deal in righteousness and that he deal according to his character, and therefore, not that he not judge the wicked, but that he not judge the righteous with the wicked, that he discriminate, and that if he were going to judge the righteous, if he were going to come in judgment, surely he could not destroy the righteous as well. The Lord, of course, gave him the substance of that by removing Lot, which is what we're learning. But notice Lot's prayer. He simply says, it's too much. It's too far. It's too hard. I can't make it to the mountains. And you can see him whimpering and sniveling as he cries before God. And then he says, now behold, this town is near enough to flee to, and it is small. Please let me escape there. Isn't it small? That my life may be saved. Isn't that pathetic? Isn't that tragic? Whimpering for one little piece of Sodom to be left for his comfort. The amazing thing is the angel let him have it. I'd have let him have it too, but I wouldn't have let him have the city. Hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there. That's an interesting statement, isn't it? I cannot do anything until you arrive there. I don't know what you believe about the tribulation, but it seems to me that it's saying that God cannot come in judgment upon men if Christians are there. Therefore, the name of the town was called Zoar. You understand, there are five cities, five towns, and four of them will be destroyed, two of which are Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, in verses 23 and following, you have the destruction, 23 through 26. I call that fire and brimstone. That's the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah in the absence of Lot and his family. Now, if I understand verse 23, it is significant because Lot has been going along, following the directions, finally, following the directions of the angels, and in effect, the sun is just breaking as Lot is entering into the city gates of Zoar. And his wife, Mrs. Lot, is dragging her feet somewhere behind, lingering. That's what it says later. His wife, who is behind him, turned around and looked back. That's tragic to me. That Lot, they are virtually footsteps from safety, his wife is. Literally at the gate of the city of safety, and she lingers and turns around. Now, lest we be hard on Lot's wife, let me simply say that whatever she was Lot plus a little bit more. That's all. And that's true of his daughters, too. She simply manifests the same attitude and actions that Lot did. Foot dragging. Song, I left my heart in San Francisco, is not new. Only Lot left his heart in Sodom, and so did his wife. The difference was she disobeyed a clear command of God not to look back. And God destroyed her, literally steps from the city of safety. I do not think that Lot turned around and saw that. In fact, I know he didn't. And so when it says that she became a pillar of salt, as I understand that, whether it was by some poisonous gas, whatever the means was, she died. And the salt in the air and so on encrusted itself about her body. And later, when he returned to that site, he found her as a pillar of salt. Tragic death on her part, and we would say senseless. Most of us have no problem with the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, nor, I guess, should we. We do not know exactly how it happened. There are some commentators who have spent a lot of pages discussing theories as to how it happened. We do know that there was a lot of bitumen material. Asphalt pits, remember, were described when the kings came down and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah were fleeing and they fell into these pits and so on. It was flammable material is what I'm trying to say. So it may well be that either by earthquake, lightning, whatever means it occurred, perhaps some have even said volcanic eruption, that some of this material became flammable. If you can imagine Mount St. Helens blowing there in the desert, but blowing not just ash, but literally molten asphalt. Seems to me that that's a bit of a picture of what we see here. It is clear, no matter what method God used, whether he used nature, such as an earthquake or a volcanic eruption, or whether some other non-natural matter, God was in control. It was a clear miracle, And the timing was certainly in the hands of God, as the angel indicates, I cannot do anything until you arrive there. And it is a destruction that is absolutely total. See, I would have expected that God would have done to Sodom and Gomorrah what he did to Canaan. Remember what he says to them? He says, I'm going to drive them out. What did God use? Bees. That's what it says. He'd take bees in and drive the people out. Why? Because then it left the houses standing. I mean, everything was just ready to move into. Furnished apartments. That's what it is. And the Israelites could move in and take over. They didn't have to build houses, plant vineyards. But God clears this place, devastates it. So no grass grew, nothing. It was absolutely uninhabitable. That was true, I think, as the Israelites passed by on their way into the promised land too. I would have thought that God would have given it to Abraham and said, you know, Lot aced you out of that land. I'll just clear these people out of here and then it's yours. But God wanted Abraham to be a sojourner, not a city fellow yet. And so God wiped it out so that nobody could move in and possess it. Verses 27 through 29, I guess, are the most refreshing verses of the entire section, because it turns our attention from the sin of Sodom to the righteousness of Abraham and his great care for that city. Abraham arose early in the morning and went to the place where he had stood before the Lord. I do not think he went to pray. I do not think he went to pray. I do not think that he went to pray for Sodom and Gomorrah. Too late, number one. Smoke was already rising. And besides that, he had prayed for Sodom and Gomorrah, and God had given him an answer. And there was nothing more to pray for. But I think his heart was still concerned about Lot and his family. I don't know whether he saw Lot escaping the city. I don't know. We never really hear of Lot, and we never hear of Abraham's finding out about it. But he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah, toward all the valley, and he saw the smoke of the land ascended like the smoke of a furnace. Verse 29 is the pearl. Thus it came about when God destroyed the cities of the valley that God remembered Abraham. And he sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot lived. One thing is very clear to me. Lot's preservation, squawking, dragging his feet, resisting all the way, had virtually nothing to do with Lot's faithfulness. And it had everything to do with Abraham. That, I think, is clear in the text. Verse 30. This, to me, this is the most tragic section of all. Because here judgment comes on Lot personally. Lot is destroyed in a slower way. It's a slower, more painful death, if you would call it that. But it's destruction. It's judgment nonetheless. Lot went up from Zoar and stayed in the mountains and his two daughters with him, for he was afraid to stay in Zoar. Why? Now, this is a theory. You can take it or leave it. See, Lot had been committed to being a part of the city. He is committed to living in the world. I'm sure that he convinced himself that he was going to be a witness, that he had all kinds of explanations, but basically he loved to be in the world. I think now as Lot looks back and reflects, he realizes he has lost his wife. He has lost sons and daughters in Sodom. And I think that now he is inclined to look back over the history and say, why didn't I realize when those armies came down and took me and all of my possessions out of Sodom, why didn't I see that as the hand of God saying, get out of Sodom? Why did I go back? Why did I join the city council? And now he begins to look over his whole concept of separation. And he says, the problem is the city. That's the problem. The city is the problem. Living amongst those ungodly people, that's the problem, and he overreacts. And now he's going to head for the cave. He's heading for the hills, but God told him to go to the hills to avoid destruction, not to live there forever, to get out of the wrath of God that was being poured out. And now he says, that's it, the mountains. Get away from all the cities. Get away from the people. protect my two daughters who are left, who are my last hope for having any kind of godly seed, and keep them from those wicked men of the cities. Off to the cave. Two daughters begin to add two and two, and they say, have you noticed that Daddy won't let us date the boys of the valley? Have you noticed when they come to the cave door, he goes with a shotgun and tells them to get lost? We're never going to get married. That's what they say. They say, verse 31, our father is old, and there is not a man on earth to come into us as the manner of earth. There were still men around. Every man on the face of the earth wasn't dead. By the way, Abraham wasn't that far away. And you know he was in the mountains? That's interesting that when Lot fled to the mountains, he didn't flee toward Abraham. I don't think he could face it. Well, the daughters begin to add two and two, and they say, it's all over. There is no way that we're ever going to get married. There is no way we're going to live a normal life. And especially now, if they were engaged to those fellows back in the city who got wiped out, you can imagine their despair is more real. And so they begin to draw the conclusion that their family is going to be wiped out unless they do something about it. It's an emergency. Calls for radical means to deal with it. So they come up with a plan. Now, even at this point, Lot still has an element of righteousness. They do not come to Lot and say, Dad, we've been thinking about it, and there's only one way that we're going to have your seed continue. They don't propose this illicit relationship to him. They know that Lot's too righteous for that. He's not too righteous to get drunk, though. And so that's how they're going to do it. They're going to pull it off with him in a semi-conscious state. They're going to anesthetize his brain. That's what they do. And as you know, they both went to bed with him, and they both got pregnant. It says that Lot didn't know when they came in, and he didn't know when they went out. It doesn't say he didn't know if. I personally believe that he was not unconscious or comatose. I think there was an awareness, although it was a sort of played down awareness because of the liquor that was given to him. The result of those relationships are two nations, Moabites and Ammonites, not Amorites, they're different. Those two nations, although God gave them a privileged position, he instructed Israel when they entered the land, don't you touch those people and don't you fight with them. But they became the plague on Israel, and they brought moral and religious disaster. They simply perpetuated the morality that they had learned. Well, let me say some things about this text. And I must say, I'm going to have to ask you to read some things in print because there is a lot that could be said. Let me emphasize, first of all, the similarities. I am very disturbed as I read this chapter because of the similarities that I see. The similarities between Sodom and our society. Last night, I watch on the news and I see that in Mesquite, at least at that point, it was 4,096 or something to 2,058 for R-rated movies to be piped into the home. Sodom. I really think that in Sodom there was at least some semblance of decency. I think they closed the door. We pipe it in. And we open the door. And I want to tell you that Sodom hasn't got anything we haven't got or more. Now that ought to say to us as Christians, the judgment is near. Lot had at least a brief reprieve. He had an hour, 2 hours, 4 hours that he could proclaim to his loved ones that judgment was at the door. We will not have that luxury. Judgment is near. We do not know how near. But an awareness of the sin of our own society ought to urge us that it is time to have a clear witness for Jesus Christ. This is no time for compromise. It is no time for silence. I also noticed the similarities between Lot and us. No, Lot and me. Lot was a guy who really was concerned about being on top. It's obvious from his decision when he was given the choice of where to live. He wanted that which was going to make him most prosperous. Materialism, I guess you'd call it, wouldn't you? Well, Lot had a lot of that, but he doesn't hold a candle to most of us. Worldliness. Well, Lot had a lot of that too. But really no more than us. Lot was a man who sacrificed his family for financial gain. Families are being sacrificed every day, Christian families, children who are brought up and reject the gospel of Jesus Christ and the religion of their parents, the faith of their parents. Marriages are ending up in divorce. There's no difference, folks. And the frightening thing is that we are so used to it that it doesn't even shock us anymore. Similarities. Well, let me say something about security. One of the things that this chapter tells me is that if you are a believer in Jesus Christ, like Lot was, as carnal as you may be, friend, you are saved. Now, I don't know what anybody else does, but that this guy is as close to the edge of being lost, and I think we would all agree he ought to have been lost, but he wasn't. The interesting thing about this is that Lot was spared because Abraham was righteous and because Abraham interceded for him. That's what I see in the text. The beauty of that is, my friend, you and I have one who is far greater than Abraham. And the book of Hebrews talks about our Lord Jesus Christ as our great high priest, our intercessor. And just as God spared Lot for Abraham's sake, God is going to spare all the righteous for Christ's sake. We are absolutely secure, but don't ever think that you will end up your life with a big smile on your face. Carnality is never worth the price. Never. Lot's an illustration of that. But he's a saved man. Eternally secure. Thirdly, the doctrine of separation. You know, I really thought when I first started studying this passage that I was going to end up having to say that our great problem is we just really have to learn to get away from the world. We can't let the world get to us. That's exactly what Lot concluded, and he was wrong. I titled that last section, "You can take Lot out of Sodom, but you can't take Sodom out of Lot." And you see, he thought he was safe in that cave. He really did. He thought if he built a wall around his daughters, if he built a wall between him and the world, he was safe. But that's where he lost it all. He lost it in the cave, not in Sodom. Somebody says, yeah, but it was Sodom that came into the cave with him. It was Sodom that had lived on in the morality of his daughters. Let me point you to something rather distressing in the text. Verse 8. "Now behold," he says to that mob, "I have two daughters who have not had relations with man. Please let me bring them out to you and do to them whatever you like. Only do nothing to these men." I want to tell you something. Those daughters learned something from Sodom. I don't deny that. But they learned more from Lot than they did from Sodom. You know what they learned from him? The two daughters who laid down with him in the cave were the two daughters who sat with him at his table. And they sat in the house and they heard their father say, "Take them. Do whatever you want, because this is a crisis and we have got to set morality on the shelf for survival." That's what he said. And that's what his daughters lived in that cave. They said, "This is a crisis. No offspring for our father. This is an emergency. And any morality that we have must be shelved to preserve a seed." They lived out not Sodom's morals, but their father's. That's what's frightening. And you see, if that's the case, then simply fleeing from Sodom is not the answer. Interesting, in the Old Testament, the city was pictured in a rather dim light. We saw that, Enoch. Remember, Cain named Enoch the first city after his son. Then Babel was built, and God had to stop the construction because men were told to scatter out over the earth. Now Lot has chosen to live in Sodom, and it's been destroyed. There's a fundamental difference, however, between Christianity today and faith in the Old Testament. And it is this. The Apostle Paul saw the city as the base for evangelism. Paul always went to the city. He did not go to the caves. He went to the cities, to the heart of where civilization was, and there it was that Christianity took root, and it spread out to the remote parts. You know what the difference is? I believe the difference is Sodom didn't have a church. Corinth did. Ephesus did. The wickedest cities in New Testament days had a church. Christians are not called to pull out of the city. They are not called to pull out of society. They are called to live out the life of Jesus Christ so that dying men may see and may be saved. And the way that God preserves the purity is by bringing His people together and having them committed to each other. Paul has to make a correction in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. And he says, when I wrote to you about separation, I was not talking about separation from the world in the sense that you cannot have contact with unbelievers, lest you would have to go out of the world, separation by suicide. He says, what I had to say about separation was, don't join yourself to carnal people like Lot. That's the kind of separation that we need today, where the church is an example of purity and righteousness, and it lives out its faith in cities such as ours to demonstrate to men that judgment is imminent and that men are only saved by faith in Jesus Christ. That tells me there's a balance. I tried to think of some alliterations. I'm sorry. All I could think of was rather than the tent and the townhouse, which is what I've been playing with, all of a sudden, Moses threw me a curve. And there was the cave, so I guess you could call that canvas, condominium, and something else, whatever you would, cave. But we do live in a balance. The Christian life is symbolized by a tent. Interesting that John says our Lord Jesus Christ came and tabernacled amongst us, tented amongst us. And that we are to live our lives as sojourners and pilgrims. The doctrine of separation is saying that we, if we are living in a way that is pleasing to God, if we are living as Abraham set the example, we must live in tents, not townhouses, and not caves. And those are the two tendencies that I see in Christianity. One segment of Christianity wants to just roll up its sleeves and just dive in and indulge all of the world that they can and still be saved. And the other side of Christianity says, no, the world is wicked and wretched, and therefore we have to head for the hills, and we have to wall ourselves off in caves. They may be caves created by architecture. It may be caves created by having church meetings every night of the week. But some way that we wall off ourselves from the world, and we therefore lose our witness for Jesus Christ. God does not want us in the cave, and God does not want us in the townhouse. He wants us in the tent. So we must evaluate our lifestyle. We must evaluate our own priorities. We must recognize that the judgment of God is at hand and that life must be lived in a different way. What was the difference between Abraham and Lot? Was it that Abraham was sinless and Lot was sinful? No, because you're going to be disillusioned by chapter 20. The title of that is, Don't Ever Say Never. and we'll talk about that in 2 weeks. The difference between Abraham and Lot was that Lot did not have a whole heart for God. He had one foot in the world and the other foot in the realm of the spiritual, and he couldn't decide which he really wanted most. Abraham was one who learned from the disciplines of God, and Lot was one who didn't. I guess we would have to say Abraham was a disciple, and Lot really was not. He was willing to believe in God, but he was not really willing to forsake all and follow it. And I wonder if that isn't the problem most of us have. Half-hearted. One foot in the world, one foot in a relationship with God, and we really want to keep them both. The end is painful.